House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, the 7th of February, 2007. Just to alert those just to the order, we're going to have a possible measure, a measure introduction here in a moment. We'll then be proceeding to public hearing through the four bills that are set in the agenda, and we'll be doing them most probably in the reverse order that are listed here. That is House Bill 2521 first, then 2508, then 2507, and then 2492, subject only to Representative Richardson's arrival because he has a special interest in House Bill 2507, so that may be taken out of order upon his arrival. And then proceeding to work session on House Bill 2357. Colleagues will take up the measure introduction. You'll see LC 3154 among your materials. This is offered up the request of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Portland Police Bureau. As always, supporting the introduction of a measure as a committee bill does not indicate anything about the disposition or support for it on down the road when we take it up. Is there a motion? We have a motion from Representative Krieger to introduce LC 3154 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote, I guess, by roll call. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House Bill, or LC 3154, is introduced as a committee measure. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2521. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2521 relates to the definition of polygraph examiner. Presently, ORS 703.010 defines polygraph examiner in relevant part as a person who attempts to detect deception through instruments that record cardiovascular patterns, respiratory patterns, and galvanic skin responses of the individual being examined. That is referring to a polygraph machine, which seeks to detect deception by recording bodily functions that are not easily controlled by the mind, blood pressure, heart rate, skin conductivity. There's a different type of lie detection method besides polygraph. It involves a process called voice stress analysis. Voice stress analysis involves measuring tremor patterns in an individual's voice to detect deception. House Bill 2521 adds persons who perform voice stress analysis to the definition of polygraph examiner. It also then provides for such persons to be licensed and regulated by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Initially, we have a panel, which I'll invite to come forward, Representative Wayne Scott, Leo Brunette, and Lonnie Brennstetter. Whatever order you choose, gentlemen.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Wayne Scott, State Representative, House District 39. Mr. Chairman and committee, I appreciate you hearing House Bill 2521 today, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of the bill. House Bill 2521 will allow private party use of voice stress analysis, a truth detection technique. Voice stress analysis, or VSA, is currently used by law enforcement agencies and private sector examiners across the country. In 2003, the Oregon legislature approved VSA for the use by law enforcement, but did not address the private sector use. House Bill 2521 would allow private sector use of the VSA in the same context we currently allow private sector use of polygraph examinations. This bill does not expand the use of VSA beyond what has already been established in statute regulating polygraph examinations. House Bill 2521 would also empower the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to establish training and licensing regulations for private VSA examiners along the same lines as they already are in place for private polygraphers. I have spoken to the director, who assured me that DPSST understands the intent of this bill and is able to establish such a framework. I would like to introduce Mr. Lonnie Brinstetter, a lifelong Oregonian and a 29-year resident of House District 39. Mr. Brinstetter retired after 29 years in law enforcement, the first four in Clatsop County Sheriff's Office, and the remaining years with the Tigard Police Department. He spent most of those years in criminal investigation and was head of the detectives upon his retirement. Mr. Brinstetter and his colleague, Mr. Burnett, will now tell you more about VSA technology, its accuracy, and the benefits of allowing by private sector use in Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, for your consideration on this.
Okay, thank you, Representative Scott. Mr. Brinstetter.
My name is Lonnie Brinstetter, Mr. Chairman, and I thank you and the panel for having us here today to go over this. We've handed out some material that will help maybe understand some of the information that we can provide, and and I'll go through those briefly. One of the items is an article that Leo Burnett and myself published in the FBI magazine last year that kind of summarizes the history and the technology that is now available in voice stress analysis. Attached to that is the back page is a list of some but not all of the law enforcement agencies throughout the United States that are currently using voice stress analysis. The other article is analysis study conducted by the Air Force, United States Air Force, as to the validity of the voice stress analysis. And then there are some sample voice stress analysis charts that are attached just for reference. And for clarification, briefly, a voice stress pattern that shows an erratic pattern is a non-stress, and those that show a uniform pattern, which is obvious on some of the last three pages, there's one spot on each page that shows a very uniform pattern, that shows a voice stress. Those are digital electronic waveform patterns. The other item is a comparative list of cases that our company, myself, conducted last year for the Korean law enforcement authorities in comparison with polygraph examinations that they had conducted, and they wanted to determine how the voice stress analysis would result in comparison. And we did a total of, I think it was 15, and we was able to concur on 12 of those. Basically, to start, voice stress analysis originated in the 60s by the military, and they wanted an alternative to the use of polygraph. And with me today, I have Leo Burnett, who is vice president of training for the company that we represent, the Diogenes Company, and he will go through some of the history and technology that's available and some of any additional information that you might have. If I can answer any additional questions as a result also, please, I'm available to do that. Leo Burnett is also a retired law enforcement officer from the state of Arizona, and he spent multiple years with internal security for Consolidated Freightways before retiring.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank you again for giving us the opportunity to express our side of this amendment to the bill.
And Mr. Burnett, even though you've been identified by others, you need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I am Leo Burnett, I've been in law enforcement in the public and private sector for over 40 years. 9 years with the Phoenix Police Department, and from there I went to Consolidated Freightways as a security person for their in-house security, and retired from that location, or from them, in 1997 when I contracted to this corporation, excuse me, as their vice president of training. The list of departments that we show on the back of one of the attachments there is only a small portion of the departments that we have trained. The one you see is people that I have personally trained. I also have three other examiners that I have trained to teach the subject of voice stress. My first encounter with it was in 1978. I was trained by Decker Counterintelligence out of Virginia, state of Virginia, with the original systems. I was trained by Michael Kratz and one of the co-inventors of the original system, Colonel Quiston, who since passed away in 1995. The system has been used by myself, I should say systems, because I used and trained on the original system that was more mechanical than computerized. When Colonel McQuiston passed away in 1995, the company was purchased from his widow by retired Colonel William Ames, who currently owns the company. And he had it set up as a computerized system, so it was much more versatile. It could be used on a laptop computer. Beyond that, we have people that we've trained all over the all over the world. We said the country, but I've trained people in Australia, Slovakia, Colombia. The Colombian military uses it at the U.S.'s urging and discretion for drug cases. Mexico, Guatemala, Saudi Arabia, I've trained 14 of their counterintelligence people. The U.S. Army, I've trained their what they call federal police at Fort Hunter Liggett in California, for their use of it. And locally here, I've trained 8 people at the Clark County Sheriff's Office in Washington, and they have 3 systems that they use. And Lane County Sheriff's Office, I've trained 2 folks there, and they have 1 system. And that's all we have in Oregon, and that's all we have in Washington. I don't market the system. I do the training, so... the marketing is done out of Florida, where the company's headquarters are. Lonnie also has been trained to teach now. He has taught in several classes with me under my tutelage, and when he trains his first class, we will do it together, but he will take over the load. The tests that we did with the Korean police, I'm not sure what they call them over there. They're like a state police or a country police, whatever they are. Their polygraphers wanted to know if the voice stress would do the same for them as the polygraph does. We did the study with them. 15 cases represented 100 examinations, separate examinations for those 15. We had no idea what their call was on any of those cases. When I say 15, in Korea, if they have one suspect and 2 victims, they polygraph everybody. We don't do that in this country. Usually polygraph the suspect if they would like to take an examination, but they do things different in Korea. That's why we had so many separate examinations to do. When we got done and gave them our results, they concurred that we had agreed with them on the 12, we had come to the same results. Of the other 3, we did not make calls on 2 of them because they were They involved victims who had been brutally beaten and raped, and the victim was showing as much stress as the suspect was. And there's good reason. That's why we don't do victims over here, especially of violent crimes. They're going to relive it every time that you discuss the situation with them. So we would not make a call on either of those two. On one of the exams, I detected that the polygraph examiner was, to me, getting out of hand with the subject. Even though I don't understand Korean, I had to ask the interpreter if he seemed to be raising his voice and asking them to answer the same question over and over. And he said, yes, that's what he did. And I said, well, then we cannot do that, because what we're getting then is whoever's being tested, if they are berated or yelled at, they're going to stress. And you have no idea whether they're stressing because they're lying or because they just got yelled at. You have to excuse me a little. I'm a little bit dry here. I'm getting over a cold. And so we haven't heard back from them at this point, but in any case, they like the system. Currently, right now, 10 more from the Malaysian Royal Police are being trained in this, and they purchased 30 more systems. A year ago, 10 of them were trained, and they love the system, and they are using it. When we have foreign countries do this, I monitor their cases. In Colombia, they do a lot of things different there than we do here. They have what you might call, they're trying to find out if these people that are working for the government are involved with the bad guys, the drug lords. And the last time they did a bunch of those, they did 300 of them. And I spot check their exams to see if they're, oh, thank you very much, if they're properly asking questions and handling their tests and making the right read on their charts. So we monitor it very closely. Getting just quickly to the point of why should the private sector be able to use this and not just the police or government agencies? The interesting thing is that they are all trained by the private sector. I trained the folks in Clark County. I trained the folks in Lane County. This is a good base of people that when they retire from their police jobs that would like to have a place to do something on the outside, so then they can hire out and contract to different police departments for doing the same thing. Right now I do work for a fire department in Ohio. I've done 5 cases for them in the last year. It's very versatile. They interview the people. They send me the tapes by FedEx. I analyze the answers and try to head them in a direction on their investigation, so they don't waste a lot of time out there chasing the wrong people. They've been very happy with it, and we've cleared up five arson cases for them in very short order, because we can do narrative analysis as opposed to polygraph can't do that because of the way it operates. We don't need to attach anything. We go by the voice, the micromuscle tremors in the voice. We can do that on recordings also. The only thing we have to be careful of is if we do take anything over a phone, which I don't like to do, is because some of the lower frequencies are taken out of some of the phone frequencies. Vonage, for instance, if somebody was trying to answer questions on a Vonage system, the lower frequencies aren't there. And the lower frequencies are which display the stress in there. There's no magic bullet. These are not lie detectors. Polygraph's not a lie detector either. They're simply instruments to help a very well-trained investigator to come to a possible conclusion. That's all they're for. As far as the private sector doing anything with pre-employment testing, The 1988 federal EPPA, Employee Polygraph Protection Act, excludes private citizens from doing anything on pre-employment or existing employment jobs. It's illegal. You cannot do that as a private citizen. If a police department hires an outside private citizen to test for them, that can be done. From time to time, when Clark County gets backed up, they've hired me to handle a couple of their cases, and I can do that as an agent of theirs. Even though I've trained them all, I'm not allowed to do that by federal law. So that should be of no concern. Most of the jobs that the private sector does are private citizens contact us, contact the examiners, and want to be tested to show somebody that they're telling the truth about something. Several of those can be domestic cases. I personally don't do domestic cases. I don't like to do them. They're too emotionally charged on both sides. I usually recommend that they have somebody else do their testing. Usually I talk them out of it because it's just too emotionally charged to be involved in it. If you have any questions,
thank you, Mr. Burnett.
Be very happy.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I got several questions. What is the effect on this test as far as medical conditions? Someone might have something that's permanent, a mental disorder, and the second one would be an illness, cold, flu, or throat condition, and then any medications that they might take to alleviate those conditions.
Yes, Representative Krieger. My answer to that is that almost all of the medications that have come out prior, let's go back 20 years. Many of the newer ones have not been tested, and they need to be. But in our training, high blood pressure medication, for one, will cause a chart to look differently. If we train what that chart looks like, but we see it in all the subjects' answers, and it's very distinct and notable. The cycles change on you. They're very far apart. They're not a normal chart. And I teach if they have that kind of a chart, if a person is stressing on relevant questions, on irrelevant questions, forget it. Just stop testing. They're not testable. You cannot test them. Maybe next week you can test them, but right now they're not testable. They're too emotionally charged. You see, we do the same as with polygraph does. All we're doing is recording on chart form a physiological reaction to psychological stimuli. I can make you stress. I can make anybody stress by the way I ask a question. A short example is we use control questions where we want them to stress. We try to charge up their emotion to get a good hard stress on that, and then we're measuring that stress against the stress on a relevant issue. So if the stress on the controls are stronger than they are on the relevant issue, as far as we're concerned, they're NDI. There's no deception indicated on that test. We don't do one test. We do a minimum of two, but usually three separate examinations on a test. Back to the medications. The medications that tend to, I call flatline a polygraph, where the charts, they don't show much reaction, it tends to enhance it on the voice stress. So we get better, the charts look better, they look stronger and more symmetric. We recommend that people don't try to use drugs before you take a test because it makes the charts easier to read for us. And there's one other medication, I'm sorry I can't give you the name of it right now, but what it's used for, we ran into one case on it. A subject had surgery on his voice box, and he could not speak at all without this particular medication. And if that's the case, they're not testable. Because what that medication does is it settles the vibrations, the micro tremors in the lower frequencies, and it would appear that everything that they're saying is under severe stress. So you would see severe stress on every answer they gave such as is today Tuesday or is today Wednesday, they would stress on their answer just the same.
Just a quick follow-up, please. Then you must do some type of an assessment of that person before you start as to some of these conditions, and do you take medications, and so that you'd be aware that this person might not be in a condition to get accurate information.
Yes, we do. We have them list all their medications, legal or otherwise, and that's the way we put it. If you've taken an illegal drug, put it down. We need to know that. I personally want to know if they've smoked three joints before they got there. I'm not going to test them. Just the same as I wouldn't test somebody that came in and was in a drunken condition. We have tested them experimentally wise, and it works. But what we do is try to protect the person being tested at all costs. I teach my students, it's up to me to test the person, be on his side, and I am trying everything I can do to get him to pass that examination. And if he's lying to me, he's not going to pass it anyway. But I'm going to work hardest to do. I don't put any inflection in my voice when I ask a question. You see, I could ask a question like, is your name John? Yes. Is today Wednesday? Yes. Did you rob the First National Bank? He's going to stress if he'd never been in the First National Bank. I glared down at him. I looked at him. I had accusations in my voice. He's going to stress. That's why it's so very important that the person that is the examiner understands that and does not do anything like that. They have to be 100% matter of fact and also extremely objective in these tests. So, did that help?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
Representative Parker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got calls about this from a retired FBI agent who's a polygrapher, who tells me he just couldn't go on enough about how worthless he thought these were. And I'm concerned. I don't want to get in the middle of a turf battle. But I also looked at, did some research with the help of our good friend Google, and it says the Pentagon has ordered a halt to the use of that. Down at Gitmo, they were using it in other places, and they're no longer using it because they feel it's no better than flipping a coin, according to an ABC report.
Yes, I can answer that for you, Representative Barker. The APA, American Polygraph Association, is a private organization who, if I want to be trained and be able to use the polygraph in the United States of America, I cannot hang their shingle on my wall unless I'm trained by a school that's approved by the American Polygraph Association. I have trained several polygraph operators in voice stress who give their subjects a choice, either one or the other. If they have the choice, they use the voice stress. It's so much simpler to use, and there's less stress placed on the person that's being tested because they can sit there at ease and answer questions. The flipping of the coin, that came out from a study that I saw the results of many years ago. It was in the 70s. It was done in Minnesota at the airport in Minneapolis St. Paul in a building out there. I've listened to the recordings. They were hardly decipherable. You could hardly hear on them. And a professor was doing these with students, paying them $5 or $10 or whatever it was on a phony crime. You can't do phony crimes. They don't work because there's no jeopardy involved. And without jeopardy, polygraph doesn't work. Without jeopardy, voice stress doesn't work. And that's where that term, it's the same as flipping a coin. I think the voice stress people were trying so hard to prove themselves, they agreed to do these, and you could hardly hear the tapes. You had airplanes coming in for landings and takeoffs, and it was noisy, and the people were not trained that tested. They were given a voice stress system, the old PSC analog system. And that's where that term came out, and they've hung on it ever since. The voice stress system is measuring physiological reactions to psychological stimuli. The the same thing that polygraph does, except polygraph can't measure the voice box. They can't measure audible sounds. You don't have to answer on a polygraph. You can be asked a question, and you can sit there, and you're going to record. The answering is just a kind of a formality thing. In voice stress, the only way to beat the voice stress is to keep your mouth shut. And when people come in to be tested by me, they ask me if there's a way to beat it, and I tell them, yes, there is. Don't answer. That's the only way you're going to beat this test. Polygraph, there are many ways to beat it, but a good examiner knows their plan. Well, stepping on a tack, biting your tongue, something or other. Does that help?
Well, why did the military quit using it? It seems to me there's a question of reliability. This guy from the FBI who lives down in Eugene, they called me, said if it worked, we would be using it. The FBI does not use it. They started using it after 9/11, and quickly the military and intelligence services, and he said they quickly quit using it because it just wasn't working. And he also ties it back to Dr. Humble.
And he's not a doctor, by
right?
The way.
That's yeah.
He's as phony as a $3 bill. I know him personally.
He's selling those. Yeah.
Yeah, I know him personally. He was involved in. I'm sorry. Yes.
And just if we maybe, like, if you could address the fact that nobody's using it. In the Air Force study you gave us, the end of that just says that in their conclusion they say, with an experienced examiner, is capable of detecting deception or truthfulness in a subject at a rate better than chance, but that doesn't say much. I mean, better than chance isn't.
The Air Force study did it. They tested 54 polygraph tests against the VSA, and they were 100% came out the same conclusions on that. That was done in Rome, New York. Detective Masucci down there in Rome was the one that trained them on how to use the system. Excuse me. I don't like throwing mud, and Dr. Hummel and I are not good
friends.
That's
fine. You don't need to address it.
But they are the ones. It was his system that was used in Gitmo or wherever it is. If you look up his history, they've also been sued several times. Their tests have not been valid. They have turned out. I have been hired to look at examinations they have done. I found some that are good and some that are totally not reliable, and they're not good because the person was not trained properly. That's another reason we don't get along very good. But I call it the way it is. If somebody hires me to look at a test that Lonnie's done, and if I agree that Lonnie did a lousy test, they're going to know about it. I'm going to tell them that. It's not a viable test. It's not good, and it should never have been used.
Why is the military and the FBI, why aren't they using it? I mean, they're saying, the people, this guy's telling me, they're not using because they're so unreliable, that the system is not reliable.
The only one that they have tried to use was the old PSC, which they had had paid for getting the PSE, Psychological Stress Evaluator, initially designed by three U.S. Army colonels, Colonel Bell, Colonel Ford, and Colonel McQuiston. McQuiston was a polygrapher. What happened was they wanted to be able to test people over the telephone. That was the whole idea of it, to tell if spies, their counter-spies, whose side are they on? Are they now against us? Are they working with the enemy? We can't do that with voice stress. And that was reported back to them. It can't be done because you don't know what's going on at the other end of that phone conversation. If the person is late for an appointment, if he's afraid that somebody's watching. I'm sorry.
I know there's some other questions, and I want to make sure that we're going to be able to get the all the responses that the committee members might want.
I can cut that one very short. And the idea was they were told, the U.S. Army was told, no, it will not work that way because the only thing we can tell you is if there's no stress in the person's voice, they're telling the truth. But if we find stress and we're not in the room with the person we're testing, we can't tell you.
Okay,
Senator Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a statement to put on the record. I spoke to, my staff spoke to Jerry Coffey, my brother-in-law, who just retired from Defense Intelligence Agency end of last year. His report was that the voice stress analysis is not proven to be reliable, and the Defense Intelligence Agency does not use it for that reason. However, DOD is now using anything available, and it is cost-effective in Iraq, they consider it to be cost-effective in Iraq.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Burnett, for your testimony. I want to share some of the concerns that Representative Barker raised, and I did find an academic study, along with Mr. Barker, used my friend Google, that was done in conjunction with the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute, where they tested one of the more popular voice stress detection technologies. They got dismal results, both in the system's ability to detect people actually engaged in deception and in its ability to exclude those not attempting to be deceptive. And they state that while many governmental, investigative, military, and law enforcement agencies have expressed an eagerness to find a credible new means of lie detection, study after study has failed to yield strong scientific evidence in support of this technology. And their concern was that the variations in stress levels in human speech were measured, but high levels of stress do not necessarily correlate with deception. And I guess that sort of reiterates what Representative Barker was saying, is that even though they may be able to measure stress, that's being able to identify that stress as deceptive stress is something that concerns me. And getting back to the purpose of this bill, and I understand it's a licensing bill, but what it would do, it expand the use of this in the private sector. And currently law enforcement has the structure there and the staff and the oversight. But I just want to express that I'm very concerned about the use of this in the private sector, given the questions about the reliability. And I guess if, to turn that into a question, can you talk about where you anticipate the use of this in the private sector?
Where I would anticipate it is people that we have trained on police departments, when they retire, historically you'll find that most all of your polygraphers out here in the private practice have been on a police department at one time or another, and they tested for them, and they have years of experience. Then when they retire, they use it as a means of a part-time income. And That's generally where the population comes from.
You may.
I think my question is more, what will they do? Where will they be using this? In what areas? In what industries? In for what purpose? Rather than who it, would be doing it?
They would be using it if somebody contacts them and wants to be tested to prove to somebody else that they're telling the truth about a given subject, or if they're contracted by a police department to use. Which the way police departments do today in Washington and Oregon, they use the state police to do their testing for polygraph because they can't all afford to have a polygrapher on staff on the small departments. And so many of them, they will hire a privateer polygraph operator to do their testing for them. And I would say that in all likelihood, most of them have been retired from a police department as a polygrapher. So they're getting the quality there. That's where most of your privateers come from, because of their background, and they've been trained properly in polygraph or in voice stress. The level of stress as you're talking about, everybody has a different level of stress, and we find that on our baseline charts. If they use the proper protocols that we teach, you'll see a baseline stress that we can go by. And then our control questions, we want them to stress. And, of course, they aren't lying when they stress on the controls. We've caused them to stress by the way we pre-tested that question, and we measure that against the relevant issue. So.
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more follow-up.
Sure.
I want to go back to, again, the private sector and where you said anybody could call anybody if they want to find out if they're telling the truth. I guess I'm looking for some examples of where this might be. I mean, sometimes I want to know if my teenagers are telling the truth, but I'm not going to call for in what context would this come up, and where are people going to be able to use this if this bill passes?
Generally, it's in domestic cases. Like I said, I don't do them. Corporate security may want to use it, but the rules are extremely stringent with the feds on that. The last one I did was for a private agency up in around Seattle, but the person has to be. I have to tell them, listen, you don't have to take this test. You can leave anytime you like. I follow federal guidelines. I give them a copy of the guidelines. And I have X amount of insurance that I have to have by the federal guidelines. And you feel free to sue me when we're done if you don't like the results.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to the private element being licensed to use VSA, is it feasible that departments of correction or sheriffs or police would be able to enter into a contract with private vendors in order to procure their services within their departments and agencies?
Yes, they could.
So, follow up? So, what we're looking for here, I think, to flesh out a little bit of Representative Bonamici's question and concern is that private sector entities would be able to contract with either private companies or public agencies in order to utilize this particular methodology.
Yes, they could. It rarely happens, though, because the federal guidelines under the EPPA of 1988 are so stringent that most of the examiners won't get involved with it. First of all, they need to follow all the EPPA rules, which aren't hard to follow, but a lot of them are afraid of it. Then when you sit down, if they hire me to examine one of their employees, let's say for a stolen television set or something, I have to spend at least 90 minutes with that person on a test. I can't do them in less than 90 minutes anyway. Generally, it's more two and a half hours to do an examination. That's pre-test, testing, post-testing, pre-testing, and on and on. And then they are constantly assured that they do not have to take this examination if they don't want to. We will not presume that they are guilty or deceptive if they don't want to take a test. We cannot make any inference to that whatsoever. They have a lot of protection out there. Not the least of which, they can sue us when they're done if they don't like what happened.
Is that in a private sector situation that you've been engaged by a business, a company, corporation?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. The guidelines for governmental agencies don't follow under the EPPA as much as we do, as much as private citizens do. And the reason for this, that EPPA Act, was because we as examiners abused that situation for years. They were testing people at McDonald's every 6 months to see if they'd eaten two free hamburgers instead of one. They were going on fishing, if they were missing 10 pounds of meat, they'd hire somebody to come in, a retired polygrapher or voice stress person. Mostly this happened in Florida and Arizona because that's where the snowbirds go. They're doing tests for $10 a piece, taking 15 minutes to do an examination and saying, why, that employee did eat three hamburgers instead of one when he was only allowed to have one hamburger. And then they would fire these kids. And that's the basis. That's why the EPPA rules came out. It was way overdue, and the abusers of it stopped doing it. In fact, most of them sold their equipment.
Follow up. Quickly.
You may, although
quickly.
I think we may be kind of exhausting
prolonging
the lines
perhaps.
Of inquiry here.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
I'm glad they didn't have this when I worked at A&W when I was a teenager. In regard to, is this the report that you call the Air Force report?
That's the one that she has there, Lonnie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a portion in there under Section 8 that talks about fusion with polygraph, and it's talking about integrating the various opportunities or methodologies for psychophysiological deception detection.
That's correct.
So this, we're not saying that voice stress analysis would replace any other PDD technology. It's kind of to be used in conjunction and companion with. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are some people by physical nature cannot even be hooked up to a polygraph examination. The voice stress can be used in conjunction with it. They can be given a choice, take one or the other. The polygraph is a perfectly good tool, as is voice stress. Most polygraphers that I've trained, they don't use polygraph anymore. They use voice stress because it's easier, simpler, and the subjects like to use it rather than have to sit there still. And it's very uncomfortable if you've never been given a polygraph. And by the very nature of the polygraph, that itself causes stress, which we're trying to get away from when we test people. But it does work. A good examiner it works fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Might use it here in some of the committees that we have in the building.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leo, I just want to kind of bring us back to what this bill does, because we're getting off on, I think, the merits of the technology. To follow up a little bit of the lines of Representative Bonamici's concern about controls, what I understand this bill to do is recognize this technology to come in under the definitions of a polygraph examiner and allow those people to be certified and fall under those rules, the same rules that apply how we use polygraph technology today. Is that an accurate statement?
That's correct.
Concerns, and I know from the standpoint of polygraphs now are under strict guidelines on how they can and cannot be used in the court of law and all those things. My question is the fact that today I think we cited we're using it in Lane County?
Yes, Lane County.
So I'm a little confused from the standpoint that you are contracted with by Lane County today. Is that?
No. I contract to the Diogenes company to do their training and train their instructors.
Okay. So just to clarify, today we have this technology being used in the state of Oregon only by state or county officers, correct? Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay. So the technology is being used in the state of Oregon, and all this bill is allowing us to do is to bring on private people, like polygraph people that are private people, and allow them to be contracted with state or county law enforcement agencies under the guidelines that we have today for polygraph people. Is that what this bill is about?
Why don't we direct these questions to counsel? I think maybe that we could kind of refine this. Recite what I think I understand, and I'll get it verified. What this does is it adds to a function within the public safety standards and training department, a function of licensing people who do voice stress analysis in a parallel track to what is already being done for polygraph examiners.
Correct.
So as I read the bill, it does not extend the use of the technology. It creates a licensing function for within that department. Counsel, have I captured that accurately?
That's actually my understanding as well.
Mine too.
Yours as well?
Yes.
Right.
Just to follow up, my point is that this technology is already being used in the state of Oregon as a tool to help law enforcement with their cases. That's what I want to make sure that we're all clear on. The question is do we want to expand this to help law enforcement by not having them hire specific people and train them, but allow them to contract with private contractors who are licensed by a government agency to be able to do this? That's the real question in front of this committee today.
There's only one voice stress examiner that uses this particular equipment. He lives in Northern California. He's a retired police captain from a sheriff's office, and he is licensed to do private investigations in the state of Oregon, but he does no voice stress testing because he is now a citizen, and he would be the typical kind of person that a small department. He only works for police departments in Northern California because they're smaller and they can't afford to have anybody do it. But in California, he can do that. Although he's licensed by the state of Oregon, but he cannot do any lie detection work. He's also a polygrapher.
One more follow-up. But he can work in California and he can work in Washington, but not in the state of Oregon. Is that correct?
He can't work in the state of Oregon, no.
But Washington?
Washington, he can, yes.
Okay.
Committee, if those are all the questions for this panel, then I'd like to excuse them and so we could move on to other witnesses here. We're going to hear next from Andrea Meyer and Amy Alkonich, and I'll invite them to come forward. And while they're coming forward, I'd like to note for the record that I have written testimony from Marilyn Lawrence of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, alerting us that there is there would be a significant fiscal on this bill because of the need to develop a regulatory program for voice stress analysis that does not now exist. So there are some there's a significant dimension to this issue that we are not going to be here today, and of course we'll not be in a position to work the bill today. So please come forward. Gentlemen, thank you very much, and if we could have Ms. Meyer and Ms. Alkanich.
Thank you.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to House Bill 2521. So the way I'm understanding this is this would be, as it's been discussed, some degree of licensing. But the problem with licensing is it suggests credibility to the science so that it can be marketed as a legitimate use. And we believe that it is, as the earlier folks on this panel, or rather the legislators, have identified through the Google search, which I confess I also used, its legitimacy is very much at issue. It's 50-50 chance. The American Polygraph Association has looked at studies and has said that throughout the years into the 90s, these studies show that it is no better than chance. The studies, also the Department of Defense has stated based on extensive research by its institute that the preponderance of scientific evidence clearly demonstrates that polygraph is far more accurate in detecting deception than voice stress analysis. As you know, polygraph isn't even admissible in court, so there's already a threshold there of suggesting that the science is not yet past a level sufficient to be admissible to court, and now we're going way back to a science that even the polygraph folks say, and the studies and the research by the institution say, is no better than chance. Indeed, while Oregon prohibits the use of this, I believe, this or polygraph type of technology for prospective or current employees, it does allow for a person to consent. Now, Representative Cameron, you were speaking about the issue of whether someone could use this in Oregon and being licensed. Again, I want to reiterate our concern about licensing the legitimacy, but I don't believe folks are barred if in the private sector they want to, as I said, call someone to establish that they didn't do it and take their chances within it. What they aren't getting is someone who is licensed as a legitimate science that they can then rely on. As Representative Flores said, I think your chances would have been 50-50 if you'd been tested at A&W when you so I'm glad. The EEOC has said for employment purposes that the use of scientifically invalidated techniques such as voice stress for screening applicants or screening or disciplining employees may subject the user department to serious liability under EEOC rules. So I think it's pretty uniform around the country and around the studies that this science is not credible at this point and should not be relied upon by either law enforcement or the private sector for determination of truth-telling. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Myers, can you comment on the fact that in Washington and Oregon they're using this technology and they're allowing training of private people to help law enforcement use it for those means? And can you also comment on the fact that we are already using the technology in the state of Oregon?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, that we are already using the technology. There's lots of different technologies and things that people promote and use in the state of Oregon without licensing that private individuals can contract with and do that. I'm not familiar with the scope of law enforcement in Oregon using this. Informally, the city of Portland isn't, at least at this hearing, aware that it's being used in the city of Portland, I guess, and hasn't probably had the time to look into that more closely. But I would really like to know what law enforcement agencies are using this, for what purpose, because it's very troubling to us if law enforcement is relying on this technology. I mean, so I think we need to say at some point that we shouldn't use something that hasn't scientifically been proven. And the fact that it can be used without licensing doesn't mean that we should provide the credibility by licensing it.
A follow-up.
Okay.
One other thing, he made a comment on studies from 1990. I think since 1990, I can even speak into my computer. The technology has changed. So I think we need to really weigh heavily studies that have been conducted many, many years ago with the way technology has been changing. And just for the record, I want to put that down.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Cameron, I'm sorry, I either misspoke or I wasn't very clear. The studies I'm looking at go through the 1990s up to there's a 2001 that I just located, and I think there's probably more frequent recent studies. But the 2001 Department of Defense, there was no change in stress scores based on the interpretation of CVSA outputs. Furthermore, there was little agreement that in stress scores among three judges. It was, again, this is an accumulation of more recent studies showing that it's no better than chance. So it wasn't 1990, and it wasn't even early 1990s, 1995, 1996, 2001, and I believe more recent studies. And I think, as Representative Barker indicated, there are more current periods of time where it's not being used by law enforcement because there are still no studies showing that it is credible. And they've been studying this since the 70s, and I realize technology changes, but there are not the studies coming forth from these same organizations now indicating that it's improved sufficiently, that it's good science.
Ms. Elkanich.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I won't add too much more to this discussion since I think everything has been talked about and most of the questions have been answered. I'd just like to say that Amy Elkanich, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, that our primary concern is the use of this by law enforcement. I'm not sure that I got a clear understanding of how much it is actually in use by law enforcement at this time, although it sounds like Lane County is at least beginning to look at using this, maybe using it, is looking at training people to use this. I'm not sure that I'm 100% clear about their involvement with this technology. Our concern is the same as the ACLU and the same as the members of this committee, that this is science that maybe has not evolved to the point where it is as credible as polygraph examinations are, and I have personal experience with using polygraph examinations. I like them. I trust the people at the police department who do them, and I find them to be very reliable. I'm concerned about a science that is not proven to be as reliable being used and being legitimized by the enactment of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for either of these witnesses? Okay, very good. I'm going to then close the public hearing on House Bill 2521. Committee, we're going to go next to House Bill 2507 because Representative Richardson was interested in the bill, and in fact, he just walked into the room. So we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2507. And we have Council Taylor here coming to assist us with this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2507 disqualifies a person arrested for a charge with murder from determining how the remains of the deceased should be handled. Established the decision should be made by the first eligible person listed under RS 97130, subsection 2.
Okay, Representative Richardson. Appreciate your patience and while we concluded that last hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I was contacted a number of months ago by Tim Pike, who is the chief deputy medical examiner for Jackson County, and he asked that this bill be brought forward. He said it's not something that happens all the time, but he finds himself when there has been a murder of a spouse or an attack on a spouse and the perpetrator is arrested, that he has to go to the jail because, according to Oregon statutes, the next of kin who makes a decision on what happens to the body of the decedent is going to be the spouse. And so he said it's a very difficult thing to try and talk to someone who has killed their spouse and say, now we need to have you sign this paper to release the body so that there can be a proper burial. This is a problem in other states as well, and other states are dealing with it. And so what he's asked is that we have this bill go through, which basically says that if a person has been arrested for killing their spouse, that the person who will make the determination as to what happens to the body will be the next one on the list. And so it's not a major fix, but it's something that when it does come up, it's an appropriate thing to do.
Any questions? Well, let me lead off with one. To what extent is this necessary as a matter of preserving evidence, as opposed to simply the sort of the feelings of relatives about who ought to be making a decision about something that is highly sensitive at a point of great stress?
Mr. Chair, it has nothing to do with the evidentiary aspect of it, because law enforcement would not release the body to be dealt with or to be processed until after they've accumulated and taken whatever evidence they need.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Thanks, Representative Richardson, for bringing this, because I'm sure it's a dilemma that people have to face, and it's not very comfortable. My only question is about that when somebody's been charged, we don't know whether they're guilty or innocent. So how about the person that has not killed the spouse and yet they have, you know, yeah, I'm concerned about the timing and those aspects before a trial can be held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, if this was a giving up of assets or had some severe aspect that would affect a person who's merely been charged, I would feel the same way. What we really have is just a list. The list in ORS 97-130 says when there's a decision that needs to be made on the disposition of a body, the first person or the first line for making that decision is the decedent through either arrangements that may have been made with a mortuary or in just prior arrangements. The second is the surviving spouse. The third is a majority of the sons or daughters 18 years of age or older. And then if not, if that doesn't apply, then it's the parents of the decedent. And so if there was this allegation, this is a time of tremendous emotional stress for the family. And so it basically says if there is enough probable cause to arrest this person, then let's have the next group in the family make the decision so that we don't have added to the stress the trauma of not knowing what's going to happen with the body. It really came up in another state where a man murdered his pregnant wife and child, and then the same situation came up, and he negotiated to release the body. He wanted money, he wanted to have visitation, he wanted to have certain things done, and he wasn't going to release the body unless they agreed to his demands. And, I mean, totally inappropriate. This adjustment by going to the next person or the next level on the list would avoid that possibility.
Thanks for the clarification.
I noticed the phrase charged with criminal homicide or aggravated murder. And I'm assuming that aggravated murder would always be a criminal homicide. That'd be, I guess, one question. So probably that phrase, or aggravated murder, probably it would be unnecessary.
Mr. Chair, I haven't reviewed the criminal statutes, but I certainly know Bill Taylor's an expert on this, and I'd answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me go to the statutes, but I think they're used to reference two different sections of the code. I can easily do that just in a couple of seconds. But
well, I guess one question, counsel, would be whether that's duplicative, and also what the scope of criminal homicide would be. I mean, I think if it were a crime involving intent, mm-hmm. we might feel differently than if it were, for example, negligent manslaughter, for example. You know, what if somebody were caused in an auto accident or something through, you know, really sufficiently negligent conduct that was criminal, whether that would be, and it'd be appropriate to apply this standard to them.
Mr. Chair, it's a real consideration that the committee needs to make. Right now, this only would apply as the statute is, this amendment is drafted, to those extreme cases. And what about voluntary manslaughter? I mean, it's a heat of passion and anger, but do we still have to have the pathologist go in and talk to that person about what happens to the body when they have caused the death to occur, or would it be more appropriate to go to the next level in the family as already exists in the statute?
Right. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative. I think that's all the input we need. I think we won't take this to work session today. I think we need to kind of reflect on some of these points here a little further.
Thank you.
Appreciate your input. Close the public hearing on 2507, and we'll go now to third. Open a public hearing.
We'll let him create.
Council Stanford, 2508.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2508 relates to what are commonly referred to as red light cameras. Under current Oregon law, cities with populations over 30,000 and the city of Newburgh are allowed to install and operate red light cameras at the city's expense. Presently, Portland is limited to no more than 12 cameras, and other cities are limited to no more than 8. House Bill 2508 amends this statute by, first of all, lowering the population threshold from 30,000 to 10,000, and it eliminates the specific Newburgh exception. Since Newburgh's population is approximately 20,000, it would be covered by the amendment anyway. It would, that in its present form, that's all that House Bill 2508 does.
Okay, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here today to support House Bill 2508, and if my voice holds out, I'll be able to complete this testimony, but you should be thankful I will shorten it for you today because of that, and that's probably something you'll appreciate greatly. With me today is Deputy Chief Brian Casey of the Newburgh Police Department, and because they have basically installed red light cameras in Newburgh, Dundee, he'll have a chance to give you kind of a first-hand look at both the experience and the process they went through, along with the results they're experiencing. And he'll do that in just a minute. The Oregon Association Chiefs of Police have been big supporters of this red light technology for an important reason. If you look at statistics from the National Highway Administration, they show that over 96% of all Americans fear being hit in an intersection. I probably didn't need to take a poll for that. You've probably experienced it yourself as you're out driving around, just how much of this behavior actually exists out there and how dangerous it feels when your light turns green and you feel the need to hesitate before you enter an intersection. Nationwide, red light running is considered one of the most dangerous behaviors on U.S. roadways. And what about in Oregon? What's the Oregon experience? Well, during 2005, drivers disregarding a traffic signal were responsible for 2,360 non-fatal crashes, 1,202 injury crashes, and 9 fatals. That's a significant public safety issue. Let me talk about the difficulty for law enforcement that we encounter in terms of patrolling or enforcing this kind of behavior at intersections. It's a very difficult challenge for law enforcement because at intersections, law enforcement has a difficult time viewing the enforcement or the violation and then has trouble pursuing the violator if they are able to observe it. Part of this is because traffic engineers try to make the most of the right-of-way that they take for intersections, and they are designed curb-to-curb. Just beyond the lanes are usually bike paths. And so what you have is an inability for an officer to sit in a spot to observe the infraction at the red light. And if they do again observe it, to pull over the violator requires them in many instances to actually travel through the red light themselves to pull someone over. The other option for law enforcement is to use more than one vehicle or officer. And the problem there is once the violator goes through the red light and they're pulled forward, I'll say upstream, just beyond the light, there's no real safe way to pull over somebody without impeding traffic up ahead of the light, which creates its own safety issue for officers and for the public. The red light cameras are nice because they give officers the ability to be dispatched to other calls for service that are already in high demand. You'll know in your jurisdictions that calls for service for property crimes and other issues often take time for officers to respond because they're involved in a variety of other important enforcement activities. Traffic is very important on the local level, and as a result, this particular tool helps free up law enforcement time to respond to those calls for service. It provides this service or this coverage 24 hours a day, thank you, 7 days a week, and so it is on guard and available to protect people at all points. Now, let me just talk to you briefly for a minute about what the components of the current law are and what we're asking in terms of amendments. I would like to ask your consideration, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for a few amendments that come out actually from most of my conversations with the members of this committee, along with other members that have cities that are interested in utilizing this technology in dangerous intersections around the state. I'll mention that in a minute, but let me just talk about the law as it currently exists. Right now, the law simply makes this permissive, and in our bill, it would continue to make it permissive. That means that there's no state mandate. Cities, through their city councils, will make the decision to employ this or utilize this technology, but there is no requirement to do so. But they do have to vote and actually choose to use it at a local level. Law enforcement cannot just go out and try to put these things in. There is a full process that's required, including public awareness. Photo red light statute requires cities to provide a public information campaign to inform local drivers of this process. And I think that Deputy Chief Casey will talk about the process they went through. It's quite an involved process to make sure that the community is fully vested in this new technology. What about signage? There's a signage requirement. The goal here is voluntary compliance. It's not a gotcha technology. And that's why signs are required immediately in advance of the intersection, so that drivers have the ability to adjust their behavior or to be aware of the potential for getting a ticket before they ever get to the intersection. It's very important. Law enforcement doesn't have any desire for this to be anything other than a reduction in the violations that occur in intersections, because we believe that directly translates into a safer intersection and avoids the need to use law enforcement resources for traffic crash reconstruction and the other things that occur when someone is hit in an intersection, injured at an intersection, or unfortunately killed in an intersection as well. Let's talk about the process and outcome evaluation. Currently, the Oregon Department of Transportation submits an executive summary of the process and outcome evaluations to the Legislative Assembly in March of every regular session. That's so that you have the ability to look and see how this program is working statewide and can evaluate the effectiveness of it. And then, as was mentioned earlier by council, there is a limit on the number of intersections that cities can have these red light cameras operative in. For cities outside of the city of Portland, the limit is 8. I think in my testimony, and forgive the mistake, I think it says 4, but the truth is it's 8. In the city of Portland, it's 12, and now would be a good time for me to mention the two amendments we're suggesting. Portland would like to have authorization to go from 12 to 24 intersections. In a city the size of Portland, that doesn't even begin to get at the real bad intersections that they have in Portland, where they have a serious red light running problem. So that would be one of the amendments. The other, in conversations with many of you, the question repeatedly is asked, why do we have a population limit at all? If cities have to go through the process they have to go through to do this, to go through the expense that's required to make actually install these cameras, why do we have a population limit? And so we are requesting that the chair and committee consider an amendment that would just eliminate the population requirement altogether. I've had, since our introduction of the bill, a number of legislators who have come forward saying, my city is just under 10,000. We have a terrible intersection. We'd sure like the ability or authorization to be able to use this technology. And so the two amendments that we're requesting involve those two things, an increase to 12 to 24 in Portland and the elimination of the population requirement altogether, realizing that there are many cities where this would never apply. There isn't a red light intersection, or the expense of utilizing the technology is prohibitive, or the city just doesn't support it. Although I would like to mention that just nationwide, they've done a number of polls on public support regarding these kind of red light technologies. The support is always at 75% and above. The public does support it, and I think it's because of that 96% of people that find themselves fearing entering an intersection because they are afraid they're going to be hit. We've all had that experience. And so with that introduction, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, with your permission, I'd like to turn things over to Deputy Chief Brian Casey. He's going to show you some of these and explain their process, and I think, with your permission, he can also talk to some of the technical questions you may have about how this works.
Deputy Chief Casey.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson and committee members. For the record, my name is Brian Casey. I'm the Deputy Chief of the Newburgh Police Department. And as Kevin alluded to, we have seen, if you've been in Oregon for any time, as myself, a native Oregonian, we've seen a huge increase in population, and for whatever reason, we've seen a decrease and the number of officers per 1,000 ratio. So this technology is available to law enforcement, and as I'll show you, it's very effective and very important for public safety, we feel. I have a short PowerPoint presentation I'd like to show you that also has some video clips from the intersection that we currently have in Newburgh that has photo red light there. So thank you. If you can all see that, if it's focused. This is just the current ORS, as you're all aware, and you know that Newburgh is mentioned in there as well as the 30,000 population, and we are limited to 8 cameras. This process started out for us in 1999. As some of you may know, we came to the legislature and asked that we be allowed to have photo red light based on our traffic congestion and traffic problems in Newburgh. This came through our traffic safety committee. One of the major complaints we have in Newburgh from the law enforcement perspective is traffic. It's interesting, but we field as many complaints about traffic and people running red lights as we do narcotics and other types of things going on in the community. In 2005, we contracted with Redflex. They're out of Arizona, and they installed the equipment in Newburgh, and it's currently been up and running since July of this year, 2006. Okay, again, as Kevin mentioned, it's difficult for us to park a vehicle on the street at a busy intersection, and I'll show you our intersections and explain that there's nowhere for them to sit. It's difficult to merge back into traffic after a violator has gone through a red light and proceed through the traffic. It's almost as dangerous as the person running the red light. There's just some statistics. In Newburgh, 5% of all of our crashes are attributed to failure to obey a traffic control device. These are some national statistics. I think more importantly, if you look at Newburgh, since August, we've had a reduction already in just that short time frame. I'm not sure that the statistics in December were complete. We do, however, anticipate that those numbers, once spring and summer gets here, where the tours and the wine industry gets going again, we'll see an increase in red light violations. I'd also like to mention that in those numbers of 83, those are only people that were able to verify and confirm that the driver is also the registered owner, as well as that we're able to get the DMV information from a state, a neighboring state, or another state that we're unable to access their DMV data. We're not able to issue them a citation. This is just a graph showing the reduction. I'll point out, this is the intersection that we have currently in Newburgh, and as you notice that this is a turn lane here, and there's nowhere to park in this area for a patrol car whatsoever. This is the light here that you'll see. If you pay attention to that, you'll see the light flash. Now, the way our system's set up, we give the violator or the benefit of the doubt in these citations, considering that an officer has the discretion to issue a citation if somebody enters an intersection on a yellow and fails to stop. However, in the way this system is set up, we're not issuing citations unless the driver's tires cross that crosswalk while the light is red. So there's absolutely no question that the light has been violated. And as you'll notice, when this light changes, you'll notice the cars in this area, and then you'll see the flashes. The light's red, there goes two cars through.
Wow.
Every day.
Now notice how heavy this traffic is out here. There's no way we can sit in that area and get a patrol car out on the highway. It's just nearly impossible. Oops, excuse me, that's going again. Same. And we have streaming video. We're one of the few agencies in the country. This is new technology that has streaming video. When somebody's issued a citation, they get a copy of the photograph in the mail along with the citation and a website that they're able to go view this violation. And what we're finding out is out of the 325 citations that we've issued, we're almost at 100% not conviction rate, because they're pleading guilty by sending in their bail money. We've had one plead not guilty, and we've got one pending. The one that pled not guilty acknowledged that he went through the intersection. However, he was claiming that he was acting as an ambulance because he needed to take his wife to the hospital, and I don't know what the outcome of that was.
Okay. Is it getting a record helper out?
I don't know if I've shown this one here or not, so. There goes a truck. Now, trucks are sometimes difficult to track down as far as who's driving it, because they sometimes belong to a corporation, or they don't have the proper plates, or the plate is not visible because it's dirty. Here comes the pilot car. Notice there's a pedestrian here at this violation. Lights yellow, red. We've had people run these lights as late as after the light has been red for up to 26 seconds. Oops, missed an accident.
Yeah. Oh.
Now, You'll notice he has his lights on here, so they were actually in a pursuit, but just do that as a point of interest. So that concludes the PowerPoint presentation. I would conclude that we've heard a word or a picture's worth 1,000 words. Well, I would tell you that a video is worth 10,000 words.
Any questions?
Not as questions or not, but I really support this bill and the proposed amendments that they've talked about. You know, in driving around Salem the last 6 years when you get here, I've actually found most people very courteous about letting you into the lane of traffic, putting on your signal back up and let you move in. But I have seen a definite increase when you come towards these intersections of the occurrence of people running those red lights. And as bad as that is a common thing that I see every day if I make a loop around this town. So I think this is something that is very much needed. I think it's supported by the public.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for your excellent testimony, oral and visual. I just have a question about the amendment that you're talking about with regard to Portland. Is that going to be drafted in a way that says City of Portland or a city with a population of X or more?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I believe it will be a population above. And the City of Portland will be up to testify in a minute, so they will probably be able to answer that question specifically. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. A couple of questions. Number one, in your first video there, the caption had to do with something, first violation gives the horse a headache. I wasn't quite sure what that caption meant.
Oh, I didn't put that. Excuse me.
Very cute, Brian. Thank you.
Was it a horse trailer? Was that it?
Representative Flores and Chairman McPherson, yes, it was a horse trailer, and I'm not responsible. Somebody else put this presentation together for me. So.
Oh, no, that would be cute.
And Mr. Chair,
notice the trailer.
Somebody that's soon to be retired.
Second, a question, not to challenge the merit of the bill at all, but the large truck violation issue, if you've got a large truck going through the red light, sometimes if it's a large enough truck, high enough in height, and you're right behind it, you cannot see what the situation is with the light. So ostensibly, you could be proceeding too and be clicked, and so it's still your fault because you probably should have stopped. And not that I've ever been in that situation.
Flores, Chairman McPherson, are you asking me that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The answer to that is if that occurs, typically what we say is you're following too close. And also, I would assert that as with the pilot car that followed the truck full of the poles, we weren't able to issue a citation of that driver because he was close enough to the back of that truck that we couldn't get a video of the driver's face.
Interesting. Okay, that helps me. Thank you.
Get close.
Just a quick question. Life is life, but this morning as I was coming through one of those great intersections in Salem, I was in shock because of the car in front of me. We had stopped for the red light, and then before the light changed to green, the person was more than three-quarters of the way through the intersection. Do you get them going? I mean, I was astounded because I thought, I would never endanger my life by going on somebody else's green or yellow. But does it do the converse? I mean, would it catch something like that, where somebody goes into the intersection when you're on a red?
Well, Representative Comp, Chairman McPherson, the system's set up as to the person has to enter the intersection on the red. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
I guess the question I would have, I think if I'm reading the question right, is that is it set primarily or entirely to catch people who are late arrivers for an amber, or does it run continuously throughout the red cycle?
Thank you.
Chairman McPherson, it's set up so that it sets itself off by a sensor when the light's red.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kopp, I also believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, hopefully I won't be, that if you were to stop at a red light and then take a right turn off of a red light, or that it doesn't catch those violators. I think it also measures a speed entering the intersection as well. I don't know if that's true, but it can be
set up that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I live in Aloha outside of Beaverton, where Beaverton has those lights. I know which signals those lights are monitored, but I think I've seen a great, it seems to me, in the Beaverton area, people don't run the red lights at other intersections because that's in the back of their mind that there's, that just like photo radar, people tend to slow down where it's worked heavily as it is in Beaverton. And as an antidote to all this, I slowed down and didn't go through a late yellow light in December, stopped and sat through the cycle. My light turned green, other traffic stopped, I pulled out, and the guy, like in one of these things, came through and T-boned my wife and I. Fortunately, nobody was hurt. We totaled my car, and so I had to go through the inconvenience and expense of that. But this is a great idea, and I would, you know, like to see, same as you're limited, taking off the number of city, or so any city that wants to do that could afford it. I'm not sure why we need to have a limit on how many, because the same thing, the economics will govern that. Newburgh can't have 28 of those. It wouldn't work, and Portland maybe needs 40 of them. But anyways, I'm looking forward to the amendments, and I support the bill.
Question about signage. I know on photo radar there are rather strict requirements about signage to alert the public that a photo radar unit is in
just
use. And is that, are there parallel requirements for photo red light?
Chair McPherson, yes there are. And I did see that there is a bill, obviously we're not hearing it today, that would change some signage requirements for photo radar. But the key is that I think at photo radar you have to have a sign entering the jurisdiction that lets people know that you're entering a jurisdiction where photo technology is being used. And then just in advance of either, in the case of photo radar, the photo radar unit, or the intersection where it's being actually used, that sign is there. And, of course, the purpose is you want to get people's attention so that they can adjust their behavior. And I think that's really been the success in this. And as Representative Barker mentioned, it's actually studies have shown that other intersections where red light is not utilized, in environments where it's being utilized at some intersections, it has a residual effect in other intersections.
So. Yeah, Mr. Campbell, I want to probe that question. Why wouldn't it be a more powerful impact on people's behavior if you didn't have advanced signage so that people were unless they happened to spot a unit that was set up without the signage, would then realize that they were at risk of being ticketed? Wouldn't it be a more powerful incentive for people to behave correctly if we didn't warn them? It always strikes me that the way the technology is hamstrung now, it's we penalize people for not reading signs.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, I think that, and not being a police officer, I don't have this experience, but I do know that voluntary compliance is very important in human nature, and sometimes our inattentiveness are part of the problem, or we're in a hurry, and so the purpose of the signs is a reminder that for those who would like to be law-abiding, but for any number of reasons have, you know, are inattentive or dealing with other things, it is their chance to align themselves with the laws as they're written. And so I guess the criticism of law enforcement would be, if we didn't have the signage in advance, well, this is a gotcha thing, or you're just trying to issue citations or make money. And so to us, the signage is very important because it does create the potential for people to comply and actually to reduce the number of people that are actually running the red lights. I guess photo radar is a little bit different in that, you know, we're not talking about the intersection where a red light could result in, you know, somebody's death or injury, but I do think that in both cases we've always been supportive of the signage requirement as a way of getting people's attention and giving them an opportunity to adjust their behavior. I think on the interstates that happens sometimes as well. If you're, you know, sometimes they put people out on the interstates to remind people about the importance of keeping the speed down. So,
if there are no further questions, let's excuse this panel and invite up Mark Landauer from the City of Portland.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I've asked Mark Lear, who is the manager of our traffic investigation division within the Department of Transportation for the City of Portland, to join us, as well as Sergeant Dan Costello with the traffic division within the Portland Police Bureau, who is also responsible for our photo enforcement program. I want to make one quick clarification, technical primarily. The current statute permits the City of Portland to operate cameras at 12 intersections rather than 12 cameras. So I just want to make that distinction. That's also true of the other cities that have a population of greater than 30,000. With that, I'd just like to turn this over to Mark Lear to present his testimony.
Mr. Lear. Representative McPherson and the committee, my name is Mark Lear. I work for the City of Portland Office of Transportation, managing the Traffic Investigations Group and our Community School and Traffic Safety Program. We appreciate the legislature granting authority for cities to use red light cameras. We think it's one of our most effective tools for improving traffic safety. Portland continues to struggle with too many crashes resulting from red light cameras. If we look at 10 years worth of data in Portland, we have over 8,000 crashes that are the result of red light violations, over 2,000 people injured, and 23 people killed from red light crashes. Our red light cameras are working very effectively with high public support. You'll see in the data that are the presentation materials that I provided to the committee that we've seen 60 to 87% reductions at our six locations, pretty consistent with the data from other cities. For what that means for us is that the rate of violation has fallen at our six locations from 2.2 to 3.7 violations per hour to 0.3 to 1.3 violations per hour. So we think that the technology is working well, and we'd like to extend it to our other high crash intersections. We included a map with our materials that highlights the top 40 crash locations in the City of Portland, and you can see from that data or from that map that we have numerous intersections in our city, almost all signalized intersections, where we have over a four-year period anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred crashes occurring. And red light cameras are one of the most effective tools that we can use in those locations. As you heard earlier, it's very difficult for us to use normal enforcement. It leads to lots of congestion and potential other traffic safety risks. The last thing I would leave this committee with is that the public support for automated enforcement in Portland has been extremely strong. We did, as part of the report to the legislature, an evaluation of our public notification around red light cameras. We do some survey work and showed 71% of people supportive of additional red light camera work. You'll see in this report that we provided you is after drunk driving, it's the number one issue, a traffic safety issue that the public would like us to look at. So we've got a lot of intersections that we've already identified, and it would be great to have the authority to extend the successful program. Thank you.
I just mentioned one other thing. Mark mentioned that we have six in operation. The City Council for the City of Portland has authorized general funds for this year to purchase an additional six cameras. So by June of this year, we anticipate that we will have hit the ceiling of having cameras at 12 intersections, and that's the reason why we've come to you to ask to increase that ceiling to give us flexibility in addressing additional intersections that we have identified in the event that monies become available to the city to extend this program even further.
And is there, so you're seeking an increase in the number of cameras. How do you feel about eliminating the limit? Just saying it could be any number.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a very valid question. As you know, this program has been in existence since, 2001, Kevin? 99. And at that time, obviously, the legislature, because it was so new, decided to put sideboards on the program. Certainly, we wouldn't have any difficulty if you chose to eliminate the limitation on the number of intersections that this technology can be used. We just thought that working within the existing structure of the statute, that 24 was a reasonable request.
How do you feel about the signage question?
I'd like Mr. Lear to actually address that.
From my perspective, there are some opportunities looking at signage to make the program more effective. One of the issues that I've constantly advocated is that when you put in a red light camera, often it's at one approach, that you put signs at all the approaches, not just at one approach for that intersection, because the signs do perform a great benefit. I think that there's other things that would be great to explore with ODOT and with other local governments about putting signs that are indicating enforcement of red light cameras, even if it's traditional enforcement, at other locations that don't have red light cameras. And maybe that's a way of getting at a little bit of what Representative McPherson, the issue that you were putting on the table of how do we get the halo effect, which is the way it's often described of having one red light camera have the most effectiveness for reducing red light violations at other locations. I mean, the only, I guess, pushback at all that I would put out there around not doing the signage is I think as we've noticed, as soon as we put up a red light camera and put the signs in, we see the 60-80% reduction. So to the degree that we're picking our areas where we have the worst violations and the highest number of crashes, I think that the program will be, my gut feeling is, the signage does help the program be more effective. I just wonder if there's ways of doing additional signage at locations that you plan to go to in the future, or that you're doing other kinds of enforcement that would help that would strengthen the program.
And to your question again, I think eliminating signage, one of the things that we've been very, very cautious about is ensuring that there's public support for the program. And as Mr. Campbell had mentioned in his testimony, this is not for us a gotcha program. It is to reduce the number of crashes, injuries, deaths that are occurring on our streets, frankly, on virtually a daily basis. We're not in this to make money. We're in this to reduce that type of behavior so that those types of results won't occur on our streets as often.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, and I just want to ask a pretty basic question so that the record's clear and that I'm clear as we're going forward. Do you use more than one camera per intersection? Because sometimes we're talking about number of cameras and sometimes we're talking about number of intersections, and I just want to make sure that if it's one camera per intersection, then we don't have to worry about any ambiguities.
Again, are we using more than one camera at an intersection?
At 39th and Sandy, I think we have two approaches. So we actually have two cameras at that location. So I think that is something that may be worth some clarification.
And again, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, if you look at the language, Section 1, Sub 5B, for example, a city with a population of 300,000 or more may not operate cameras at more than 12 intersections. I think that's the operative issue that I believe your question is directed to. We can use 1,000 cameras at an intersection. We just can't use 1,000 cameras at 13 intersections.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think primarily if I'm getting to the chair's concern about should we sign for this type of thing, and if we didn't have the signs, maybe it would be a better inducement for people to behave because they're going to get caught. But I would remind us that in traffic situations, have you ever seen the click it or ticket sign? It's kind of trying to inform our behavior to wear those seat belts. And I guess it's also an inducement if you've ever been ticketed and got a $94 ticket for not wearing your seatbelt. It is 94, 97, one of the two. Not that I have, but that's what I've read on those signs. So it does influence our behavior to have that reminder there, and I think that's a good thing.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad she said that, because I know she's falling too close.
That was a hypothetical inquiry.
If there are no further questions, then we excuse this panel and invite Andrea Meyer.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. I usually don't do the personal, but for full disclosure, I was actually a victim of someone down in Salem running a light. He was an 80-plus-year-old gentleman from Redmond and
careened into my car. It was a lovely morning. And also, for purposes of full disclosure, I was alleged to have violated not the photo red light stop at the van that's set up for speeding. I can say before you that that case was dismissed. And if that section comes up before this committee on 810, 438, and 439, I'd like to participate because there is a Court of Appeals case on how the law does not quite jive right now. With that said, I do want to raise some concerns that haven't come before the committee yet on these, and which is the companies that are profiting from this type of enterprise. Willamette Week last week published a story about the city of Portland, which uses the affiliated computer services, and they take 45% of the city's cut. In Canada, they just wrapped up a 19-month investigation of this company in Edmonton, and charges were filed for bribery, alleged bribery of over 90, and at the same time, they'd secured a $90 million contract for 20 years. Portland renewed its agreement with ACS in a no-bid contract. And I think Willamette Week is looking further into this. So, likewise, Newport uses Redflex traffic systems in St. Petersburg, Missouri. The mayor pled guilty to accepting a bribe from Redflex traffic systems. So, I don't have an answer for you today in terms of the checks and balances. You know, that does distress me when we talk about removing the limitations on the number, because someone is making money, and I appreciate the City of Portland's testimony that they aren't using it to make money, but these companies are. And they're the ones that calibrate the machines, and I know the city does some auditing, but they're the ones who are in control of this and who it is a financial incentive. And we do have evidence of the companies working in Portland, in Oregon, have engaged in criminal conduct. So that's very disturbing to us when we are turning over this technology, when you are not stopped by a law enforcement officer. Let me tell you, getting a ticket 3 weeks after an alleged event, your memory is just not as clear about it. So, you know, I understand all the safety concerns, but we need to have some protection for Oregonians, so that our cities and these companies are not engaged in profiteering. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer, because I do really appreciate your perspective on all issues. But are your concerns really focused on the purpose of this bill rather than the misuse of business and individuals in government?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, I mean, certainly is my concern about the purpose of the bill. The purpose of the bill is to prevent traffic accidents. So
right.
Let me be clear, the ACLU does not support traffic accidents.
Okay.
As a victim of one. But it is not just the company, but I think what cities get induced to do, because there is a temptation to, as we've seen, to come back and want more power or more cities doing this. And on the one hand, there is a legitimate argument of safety. On the other hand, there is the risk without some sufficient oversight of cities making money off of this, mm-hmm. because it is profiteering if you don't have to have the bodies out there. The companies making a good chunk of money, having no big contracts going on across the state, and using these companies, which at least two of them have engaged in impermissible activity. So what are the safeguards? I think we definitely need some safeguards, and I'm concerned about any legislation that just sort of, we kind of just open this up purely and don't have those safeguards.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair McPherson.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, do you think it would be helpful if we were to set a law that sets percentage of the amount of money that the ticket companies could get, as we do, for example, with the lottery? Do you think that would be a safeguard that...
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, I think that is one way to start going, to provide that safeguard so that they're not getting 45% of the City of Portland's cut. And again, I'm taking this information from Willamette Week, and like all newspaper sources, I wouldn't want to rely on that as my ability to have done the actual checking with the city. But they're getting a good chunk, and that seems to be according to the Willamette Week, I mean, there's a chunk that goes to the city, then a chunk to the state and county, so it's shared. So they're not getting 45% of the ticket, but they are getting 45% of the city's share. So, yes, I think that's one way. You know, I worry about the auditing and ensuring that the calibration of these machines, what cameras they're using. I understand from the City of Portland, they're got some safeguards in terms of people fully having gone through, because calibration could be a problem in different states that has arisen on this, where the company calibrates it and gets a lot of people who it's a gray area. So we want to make sure that there's safeguards so that it's what I think we heard, which is they're really violating it, not gray, so that safeguard as well.
One other thing, one of the last times, if not the last time I was in traffic court, there was a woman who was in there with a citation, and she was greatly concerned. She said, yes, that was her car. She and her husband were in court. Yes, that was her car. Yes, that was her driving, but she didn't know who that man was sitting beside her, and couldn't imagine how the camera put him in there. So.
I'll leave that one alone, Sheriff.
If there are no other questions, Ms. Meyer.
It is hard to remember.
We have one last sign-up witness here, Troy Costales from ODOT.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'll cut to the chase and not repeat any prior testimony. Why is ODOT here at the table relating to this bill? Two things. First, operationally. The Department of Transportation is involved in this program because of the link to DMV. There's a 10-day time turnaround in the process of these citations that are issued. So the cities that choose to operate this program have to have an in to the DMV system in order to verify registration and all the information in order to then turn for law enforcement agency to determine whether to issue the citation forward. There's a small impact to DMV relationship to programming and lighting up these cities to be able to have that connection. Secondly, as part of the handout to you, the thicker document in the back is the red light running guidelines, last published in 2004, based on a 2003 change by this body, specifically about the timing of the yellow into the red. There is a guideline. There's a national association that has that guideline. The formula and directions to the cities that choose to use this program is embedded in those guidelines, as well as the signing, recommendations to go above and beyond what is required in law to make sure that the people have an understanding of what they're getting into in relationship to the intersection and the potential of a citation. And third is the report, as Mr. Campbell alluded to. My office presents to you, the legislative body, March of every other year, a compendium of all the individual cities of what they have done in relationship to their program. The one thing I would ask of you potentially if you're thinking about amendments is whether or not the ODOT report is providing any value. At this point in time, all of the cities also have to report every March. And so all what we're doing is basically summarizing. We have no authority or jurisdiction over the programs. So it's a question of whether or not we're actually giving you further information to make choices from, or is it the individual programs that are out there that are giving you their direct responses to the same exact things in statute, and so it's actually giving you the information you need to make choices on the policy of this program. The second element of why I'm here is programmatically, as has already been mentioned. This is one of the most major things that you can do to protect innocent people as far as vehicles going on their green, or as you saw in one of the video clips, pedestrians in areas. Just think of that pedestrian had been on the other side of the intersection. They would have progressed into the lane of travel. They happened to be at the corner where the violator was and hesitated. But if they're on the other side, 45, 50 feet away, they would have not seen the vehicle coming through. We actually would have unfortunately witnessed probably an injury, if not a fatal crash, based on the speed of that vehicle. Driver behavior, that's what the signs are there for, to try and have an impact beyond just the violators themselves. And this set of guidelines, these programs have been proven not only in the United States and in Oregon, but internationally too, to have a direct impact on lowering death and injury, because it's unacceptable that we have 450 people dying on our roads and streets in Oregon just because we have a public road system. This is a way to get at it that's been proven and works. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to answer any further questions.
Representative Cameron.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Troy, you just brought up a question that popped in my mind. We're talking about cities here. What about the jurisdictions of county roads, some major highways that have some pretty heavy intersections? Is this the way this bill's written? It has to be within the city limits?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, you are correct. Within city limits, in some cases, that is an intersection with a state highway. Then the department, through its traffic unit, gets involved in negotiating how that works. We don't interfere with the traffic signals at that intersection. But it does not allow counties or state highways outside of city limits.
Maybe somebody follow up. Maybe somebody could provide us some information, as Portland has done with some of the intersections that are county-controlled or state highway-controlled that have a lot of deaths and accidents, too. That'd be good information to have for this committee.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Constales, under the existing statute, do you think that the concerns raised by Ms. Meyer with regard to the calibration and maybe even the whether the company that the city has contracted with is bona fide business operating properly, do you think that that might be able to be addressed under the reporting requirements that are existing in the current statute?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, the current requirements set a one-second reaction time and then a deceleration rate of the vehicle moving into the intersection. The traffic detectors are actually upstream in the road in order to help associate with the violation and when they go through. The jurisdictions in Oregon are setting their limits beyond that, so there's an additional time added on top of that to give the driver even more of a time factor to go through the intersection. You mentioned the deputy chief commented that it's full red, and it's full red for a set of time before they even go through. The guidelines are less than that. So the cities that are doing this are giving the driver more of a benefit of the benefit than they are have to by current statute and current guidelines. So as far as the auditing, that's up to the individual cities to look and see is the timing correct, and if an individual can prove their case in front of a court saying the yellow was only so long and it wasn't, one of the nice things about that you saw the video clips, you can see the length of the yellow. Most of us think yellow lights are quick. If you actually sat there and watched it, the yellow lights are actually quite long, giving you the benefit of the doubt. Based on the speed of the road, they're adjusted based on 55 is a longer yellow than a 25.
Thank you.
Committee, if there are no further questions, what I'm going to suggest on this bill, I think there's clearly a desire to act on this bill, but I would say the precise direction of all the actions that is unclear. So I'm going to invite volunteers off after we adjourn the meeting for a work group that would focus on these efforts and decide what direction this bill ought to take. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2508. We will not take up the other two items on the agenda. We were scheduled for public hearing on House Bill 2492, although there's nobody on the sign-up sheet, so I'm assuming I didn't frustrate somebody who had come to testify on that. We also were set for work session on House Bill 2357, but because we're finished with our allotted time, we're going to set those over to our next agenda. That concludes our agenda. We are adjourned.